Come end of June, I'll toss all her things in the dumpster. He glanced down at his watch. That's 3 weeks. You'll be gone by then anyways, right? Hey friends, how are you? Keith Tyler, bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I am tickled pink to have you with me. Thank you so much for tuning in. Gabriella Stittler and the Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine bring us our first story, and it's called Quick Turnaround. Phase 1. Seamus Black was 3 days into a 3-week stint in a third-floor finished rental overlooking a rusty shipyard in a town that couldn't afford to survive without it. He had come by the assignment as a favor to an old friend. A last-minute call had him on a plane from somewhere south of Washington to somewhere on Maine's rocky coast with veiled assurances that everything would be fine. Just fine. 3 weeks, easy in, easy out, easy money, his friend had said. Trust me. Seamus, who had always been willing to do much for old friends in tight places, agreed. But 3 weeks was quick turnaround, even for him. He was a man of a certain age, divorced for a certain number of years, living out of 3 suitcases in mostly clean, furnished rentals or mid-ranged hotels. Strings, he had decided sometime around the divorce, were dangerous. Give anybody enough of them and they'd wrap you up and stab out your heart. I know a guy, his friend had said, a guy who owes me a favor. He's got a place you can stay with ocean views. As Seamus poured his second cup of black coffee, he supposed that from certain angles, in certain weather, the place might have ocean views. He tried not to think too hard about the tired teal carpeting that smelled like cigarettes and bleach, the unfortunate floral wallpaper and the vinyl blinds that were dog piss yellow from age. Instead, he tried to think about how conveniently suited it was. He was willing to forgive a lot for convenience. His eyes kept wandering back to the powder-soft pink envelope on the folding table in the kitchen. It was the second envelope since he'd arrived, addressed to the woman who'd been there before him. The woman who had disappeared. The thing was thick, the way envelopes were when stuffed with the drugstore cards, marking important life events. A birthday, an anniversary, a graduation, a death. He knew. He'd sent enough of them to his kids. Well, for a while, anyway. Somebody had written the woman's name in tidy block lettering. It wasn't the cursive of an old relative, an aunt or grandmother, who navigated the world with a Rolodex and cup of reheated decaf coffee. It didn't waver or loop or sway. Those tidy block letters were unsuited for a powder-soft pink. You know, he knew better than to want anything to do with that envelope. By the end of his second cup, he decided to drop the thing with Jones in the rental office and get on with it. Jones, with his paunchy gut and watery eyes, kept the first floor for himself. How Jones had come to own the old Victorian that had been carved into furnished units, well, Seamus didn't know. He also didn't know why Jones owed his friends a favor. As a rule, he didn't ask too many questions. This came for the woman, Seamus said by way of greeting, dropping the envelope on Jones's desk. It's not my job to deal with somebody else's mail. Jones was watching a replay of a Sox game that was muted behind him on a box TV anchored to the wall in the upper corner of his office. Jones peered up at him with those unblinking pinpoint eyes and that glistening pink jowly face. Yeah, put it in the other stuff in the closet. She left a bag. Her mail isn't my responsibility, Seamus said again, slower this time, enunciating just enough to make his view of Jones, of the envelope, of the whole situation clear. Jones shrugged, but didn't bother looking away from the television. Thing is, she rented the place through the end of the summer, so technically the room is still hers. I let you have it as a favor. Jones slid the pink card back toward him. She won't come back. Hasn't been here for 2 weeks. Poof! Disappeared. Like she never existed. Come into June, I'll toss all her things in the dumpster. He glanced down at his watch. That's 3 weeks. You'll be gone by then, right? 1 week to assess the problem. 1 week to cut the excesses. 1 week to staunch the bleeding, in and out. Shouldn't you try to find out what happened to her? Seamus said instead. Jones looked mildly appalled. It's not my business. She paid and left. Maybe something better came up. Not much to it. And if she shows tomorrow? Jones's face broke into a smile with surprisingly straight white teeth. Well, then you got yourself a roommate. Seamus wanted to punch Jones in the face, but instead he picked up the envelope and went up the 3 flights to his rooms. He opened the closet door and dropped it in the bag with a handful of other pieces of mail and went about his other, more important, business. He mostly forgot about the pink envelope and the little black bag in the closet, but the woman, whoever she was, re-entered his life every morning when he'd get 2 copies of the paper. A redundancy that was no doubt a boon for the local economy. Now I can't cancel it, I'm afraid. We don't reimburse. We've been paid for throughout the summer subscription, the man said when Seamus called the paper to cancel it. Give one to a friend, the man said helpfully, before he hung up. Part of what makes Seamus good at his job was his dislike for waste, and that second copy of the paper made him feel distinctly uncomfortable. If he was being honest, it wasn't only the second paper and the mail. There were pieces of the woman scattered throughout the rental, old takeout menus in the drawer near the fridge that hummed irregularly but insistently, a pink toothbrush with a mostly empty tube of toothpaste, traveling-size shampoo and conditioner that he had made the mistake of smelling, a small stack of books left on the nightstand, including one that was mid-chapter, with a receipt to the bar across from the shipyard. And there was the hair. Long strands of dark hair on the couch, in the bathroom, under the covers. It was the closest to intimacy he'd been since Kathy and the divorce. Other, of course, than the occasional woman at bars who seemed equally lonely at night and equally eager to leave the next morning. By the third night, he found himself imagining what she might look like with long, dark hair. Phase 2. By the end of the first week, Seamus completed phase 1. He called his friend outside Washington, who answered on the 3rd ring. The place is bleeding revenue, he said by way of greeting. A few big leaks and a handful of smaller ones. In the background, he could make out the low laughter of a woman who was decidedly not his friend's tight-lipped, disapproving wife. But it wasn't his marriage to try to fix, thanks God. What do you propose? His friend asked. Well, a few strategic cuts to trim the fat, restructuring in the upper management, a thorough crosswalk of inventory and procurements. You might come out ahead. You're my blessing, his friend said after a pause that was longer than necessary. And you are worth every penny. Seamus, I owe you. That much, at least, was true. Seamus hung up the phone without saying goodbye, old friends being like old habits, hard to kick. Next week, no matter how strategic the cuts, good men would lose their jobs by no fault of their own. He'd been on his side of the table long enough to know grown men would shatter and beg. It wasn't pleasant, but then, in his experience, necessary things often weren't. During the final bitter end of his divorce, Kathy had accused him of being heartless. She'd said he'd never really known her, and maybe she was right. He had reminded her how much she liked the lake house and the country club and the expensive French lingerie she wore to bed for somebody else. Their marriage was past saving, after all. That night, Seamus didn't go out for dinner, uninterested in attracting the attention of the shipyard employees. They'd figured what he was there for and mostly ignored him. But it felt disingenuous to smile at them over a beer and pretend like everything was fine. Later, after the cuts, he'd go for dinner, and they'd know enough to stay the hell away. He poured himself a whiskey and settled in to read the interrupted book left behind by the woman who had absconded. What with and where to, he wasn't sure. It was a good book, and he wondered if she had enjoyed it too. He had just poured his second drink when the doorbell rang. He glanced at his watch. It was past 9 o'clock on a Friday night in a town where he didn't know a soul. Well, not really. He slid the woman's receipt back between the pages and tucked his shirt back in as he made for the door. The stoop overlooked a quiet street lined with tall, carefully trimmed elm trees and banners for the 4th of July, which was still 3 weeks away. A tall, thin man was standing toward the shadows, one hand under his jacket and one poised to knock again. He wore a battered ball cap that half concealed his eyes. He dropped his hand and stared at Seamus. Seamus stared back.
"She here?"
the man asked in a low voice that was raw at the edges, like he smoked a pack without water or had recently been throttled. There was an undercurrent of aggression to the question. Seamus was not a large man, but he didn't like to be pushed around. As a kid, he had the bad habit of leading with his fists, but as he was older and wiser, and barefoot with his reading glasses sliding down his nose, he didn't like his odds against a skittish guy with a gun. And he knew with certainty the thin man had a gun. He waited a breath too long, just to show he could, and then he said, "No." The thin man's eyes narrowed, darted to the room behind him, and back to his face. "You expect her back?" Seamus considered asking a handful of ill-advised questions, but decided against it. 3 weeks, he reminded himself. He shrugged. "Eh, can't say." The thin man's lips twisted into a bitter approximation of a smile.
She got to you too, huh? Plenty of good men fall like a house of cards for a piece like her."
Something about that comment set wrong with Seamus. The thin man noticed and shook his head before turning to walk away.
Just tell her I'll be back," he said over his shoulder.
Seamus didn't catch his name, but then the man hadn't thrown it. He closed and locked the door and debated returning to his whiskey and his reading and the relative quiet. Instead, he opened the closet, stared at the missing woman's bag, packed and waiting. But waiting for what? Later, as he lay in bed with the windows cracked and the fan pushing the warm air around, he almost felt her breath on his neck, promising something so sweet his teeth ached. He fell asleep, trying to calculate how long it had been since he held a woman and woke up cold and alone in the middle of the night. On Monday, he cut 6 of the 12 upper management positions. One of the men punched the wall and stormed out. 3 were stoic as hell, having guessed what was coming. One wept and then apologized. But the 6th man, Tom O'Brien, with a military background that read like serialized war fiction, leaned back, crossed one leg over the other, took a cigarette out of his pack and smoked it. Seamus went back to working, or pretending to. O'Brien stared at nothing in particular, tapping the ash onto the floor with an occasional flick of his thumb. When he finished, he ground it into the desk in front of Seamus and shook his head. "You've no idea, do you?" he said, his voice entirely flat. He looked tired and possibly angry. Seamus shrugged, unwilling to commit to an unscripted conversation. In his experience, desperate men needed little in the way of provocation. He pushed the termination paperwork forward and watched as O'Brien signed the necessary forms with familiar block lettering. The sounds from the shipyard, heavy and metallic, stretched between them. O'Brien finished and shook his head again, slower this time. Then he laughed to himself, stood, and walked out. Seamus waited for the door to close, the footsteps to recede before brushing the ash to the floor and organizing the papers on his desk. He continued to work, but found his mind wandering back to the tidy lettering in the pink envelope. On Tuesday, he consolidated 3 departments and cut 18 more positions. He gave the necessary notice through the appropriate channels. Responsibilities were redistributed. Like the woman, maybe because of her, he started eating at the place across from the shipyard. George's, a traditional sort of bar with fried food, sticky floors, and watermarked cutlery. He sat at the counter near the corner and watched the workers from the shipyard come and go. Blue-collar men with sturdy canvas pants and grease under their nails. The bartender was thick-armed with elaborate tattoos of an octopus surrounded by cherry blossoms and a bull in a field of daisies. They seemed sentimental and whimsical. Despite his better judgment, Seamus found that he liked the man for that alone. On Wednesday night, when it was quiet, he asked the bartender about the woman. Why? Well, he wasn't sure. It just kind of slipped out. The bartender crossed his arms and went from ironic to imposing in less than 5 seconds. Why? He asked. There was an edge of menace that wasn't lost on Seamus. He took a slow sip of beer and shrugged before answering honestly. You know, I don't know. He rolled the label on the bottle down with his thumb, curling it tightly and letting it go. She left a bag and some things in the rooms, little things, toothbrush, shampoo, things women don't like to travel without. And it got me thinking that maybe, just maybe something's wrong. The bartender's expression didn't change. You make it a habit to go around asking questions about things that seem wrong? Seamus shrugged. No, not usually. But when a man shows up at my doorstep with a gun and a bad case of nerves asking for a woman who disappeared, then I start asking questions. The bartender didn't speak, didn't move. He just stood there with both hands on the counter leaning forward, the tattoos on his forearms bulging. I can tell you want to ask, but won't, so I'll do you the favor and volunteer my information, Seamus said, throwing a 20 on the counter. A tall, thin man has been asking about her, and she's vanished, almost like she didn't exist at all. Now, if you ask me, she's running away from something or someone, and whether I want to be or not, I'm in the middle of it because Jones can't be bothered. I'm not asking for anything other than help finding out if she's all right because it feels like somebody ought to. They stared at each other for another minute. Then the bartender walked away to take an order. When he came back, he seemed thoughtful. Look, I don't know her. Sometimes she talked to Jenny, one of the girls that works here weekends. She seemed like a nice kid. Didn't talk to too many people, kept mostly to herself. She said she was here on vacation. Seamus picked up on the skepticism in the man's tone. She said that, did she? The bartender shrugged, and then wiped off the counter with a damp rag. Jenny said, she said, she came in 2 weeks ago and she didn't finish a sandwich or a drink.
He picked up a pint glass and wiped a smudge off the rim, eyes flicking to Seamus's nearly empty bottle.
Seamus shook his head and dropped a 20 on the counter. Any thoughts on where she went?
The bartender shrugged again, tighter this time.
Where does anyone go when they leave a place?
Did you get the impression she was running away from something?
The bartender picked up the bill, rubbing it between his thumb and forefinger thoughtfully. After a minute, he said,
Yeah, usually people running don't want to be caught.
Seamus forced a smile. He realized how uncharacteristically noble he sounded, how unaccountably foolish it all was. He was supposed to be in and out in 3 weeks, and he was halfway there. Why make trouble? Why ask questions?
The bartender put the money in the register and jerked his head for Seamus to lean closer. He lowered his voice to a near whisper, little more than a soft rumble in the sea of conversation that would only grow louder by the pint.
I'll see what I can dig up. Jenny might know something. But I repeat, something my old man used to tell me. Only a fool goes looking for trouble that isn't his.
There was nothing to say to that, so Seamus ducked out past a corner with the men from the shipyard, their table cluttered with empties and their eyes trained on him. The sun had slipped behind the horizon, and the night air was warm with hints of metal and salt. During the day, the town echoed with the sounds of the shipyard. But in the evening, a soft silence slipped down over the sleep town, interrupted by the sounds of waves against the granite breakwater and the occasional cawing of the gulls. He crossed the street into the residential section of the town that had wood-sided Victorians mixed with cedar-shingled Cape Cods from the 50s and mossed-over brick walkways. His footsteps were muffled, and so were the ones following him.
Seamus stopped under one of the flickering lamp lights and waited, his back to the pole, his hands circling into fists without thought, some long-buried survival instincts having kicked in. But nobody came. He retraced his steps past Jones's open first-floor windows and the sound of Wheel of Fortune, and past the young couple on the second floor fighting. Again. With the heat, they kept their windows open, and he knew all their business. Not enough money, too much drinking, the usual. Loud fights followed by louder sex. Suddenly, Seamus felt old and tired. Had he ever been that young, so hopeful and so foolish as to stick with it? He fell asleep, imagining the dark-haired woman next to him, breathing evenly, no longer a stranger. Phase 3. On Thursday of the third week, it rained the sort of a heavy summer rain that felt hopeless and melancholy all at once. It was just after lunch that Seamus figured out what O'Brien had been referencing. It was the nervous secretary who drew his attention to it. Earlier that week, he had asked for some important files detailing some classified military projects. The woman slipped into his office, closed the door, and squeaked out that she couldn't find them. He stared at her. She stared at the floor.
What do you mean, you can't find them? He asked.
She swallowed and seemed to shrink even lower to the ground.
I looked in the places where they're supposed to be, and they aren't there. So I asked the people I thought might know. They don't. It seems like they're gone.
It was O'Brien's department, she added, almost flinching, and O'Brien isn't here anymore.
Seamus glanced at the glinting ring on her left hand and wondered how often her husband beat her.
He softened his voice and asked her to bring the list of people she'd talked to and to close the door on the way out.
He called his friend in Washington, who answered on the first ring.
"You have a problem," he said. He told his friend what he knew. The conversation went as well as he could be expecting, with a friend cursing, then silent. "Look," Seamus said after a long stretch, "I agreed to 3 weeks. I'll do what I can between now and this weekend, but you need to send somebody else to manage the rest." His friend hung up. Seamus called O'Brien, who didn't answer. He spent the rest of the day closed in his office digging up details on the missing file. Seamus went to dinner at the pub, lost in his own thoughts and wet from rain. The atmosphere was thick. The workers appeared sullen and bored, staring at him and at each other the way people did before trouble was started. The bartender picked up on the tension, his eyes tracking the table, and Seamus with a warning expression. Seamus drank his beer and picked at the side salad he didn't want to eat, but he'd ordered it for the heck of it.
You heard one of them was found dead? The bartender asked carefully when Seamus was paying up. It's got them all a little on edge.
When he picked up the 20 Seamus put down, he left a slip of paper with a number without saying a darn thing. Seamus pocketed it and nodded, once and quick. He walked by the table of workers, and two of them followed him out. One unsteady on his feet, the other appeared to be holding him up. It was still raining, heavy summer drops. Seamus opened his umbrella.
"You here? What happened to O'Brien?"
the unsteady man called after him, not moving from under the pub awning. Seamus kept walking.
"He's dead. They're saying he put a bullet in his head,"
the man called out after him.
"Thought you'd want to know."
Seamus didn't want to know. He kept moving, maintaining a steady cadence and blank expression, thinking about O'Brien's tidy writing in the pink envelope. The number in his pocket felt heavy. When he got to his room, the door was unlocked. He pushed it open. The thin man was standing near the kitchen window, his gun in his hand. Seamus was careful not to move.
"She back yet?"
the thin man asked. Seamus shook his head.
"I don't think she's coming back," he said.
The thin man let out a brittle laugh.
"Like hell. She's here somewhere, and I'll find her. I have to, especially now that O'Brien's dead."
"Yeah, too bad about that," Seamus said. "He didn't strike me as the type." The other man stared at him. Two breaths passed. Then he said in a low, deliberate voice,
"Last I checked, a shot to the back of the head isn't suicide. Tell her I'm waiting."
He tucked the gun back into his pocket and left, leaving a puddle of water on the linoleum floor where he had been standing. Seamus locked the door behind him and sat in the kitchen with the lights off. He took out the slip of paper and stared at it. She was in over her head, in it to her eyes, in it deep enough to drown. He dialed the number. It went to a voicemail box that hadn't been set up. He hung up but didn't move. 2 minutes later, the phone rang. It was her. With a breathy voice, soft and low, softer than he'd imagined. "Hello? Where are you?" he asked. There was a stretch of silence.
"Are you the man from the bar asking about me?"
He didn't answer the question.
Look, she said after a minute, "I can't tell you where I am, but I can meet you tonight at the pier. Can you bring my bag?"
"Why don't you come get it?" There was another stretch of silence.
"I think you know the answer to that."
He did. "You need to leave?" he said.
"I know," she replied.
It was a foolish instinct, wanting to help. He knew it, but he said, "Fine. At the pier, around midnight, I'll bring the bag."
"And the mail?"
she prompted.
"And the mail,"
he agreed. She let out a long, slow breath and hung up. He listened to the dial tone for a minute and poured himself a whiskey, skipping the ice. The rain didn't relent. Seamus wore a black jacket with a hood and tucked the mail into the woman's bag. The weight of that pink envelope still too heavy. He took a roundabout path, slowing at windows, slipping down dark alleys, and eventually working his way to the pier. It was pitch black, and the water was choppy, crashing against the rocky cliffs. The footpath down the pebbled beach was slick, and Seamus' descent was steady and slow and cautious. A rat brushed against him at one point, scurrying to a piece of pizza crust that had been left behind. The tide was coming in, and within the next few hours anything remaining would be swept away into the ocean. He was careful of where he put his feet, avoiding the tidal pools. One wrong step and he would slip. How easy it would be to break a leg or worse on a night like this. At one of the pier's legs, he could make out movement, a figure, small and huddled against the splintered wood jutting upward. He knew it was her. The waves and the rain drowned out any hope of communication. He went to her. Seamus wasn't a tall man, but he towered over her. She was wet, and her skin was pale in the moonlight. She looked up at him with wide, dark eyes. Her mouth was moving, but he couldn't make out any noise. He stepped closer, close enough to touch her. From a distance, she appeared young, but up close, the faint lines around her mouth and eyes told a different story. Were you followed? She asked. He shook his head. She let out a breath, slow, short. She glanced behind him, a quick, measured glance, a glance so quick he almost missed it. Did you bring the bag? He nodded again and reached under his coat. She stiffened slightly, again so measured he would not have caught it if he didn't know what to watch for. It's okay, he said. I'm just getting the bag, just to hand it to you. She nodded, not taking her eyes off of him. He handed her the bag. And the mail? In the front pocket. She opened the pocket, and some of the tension eased from her shoulders. She smiled up at him. A beautiful, soft smile. She stepped closer, and he caught the faint, familiar smell of her shampoo mixed with salt. Why are you helping me? She was so close they were almost embracing. He could have stopped there, stopped and walked away, but he didn't. He needed her to know that he understood, really understood. He said, because O'Brien is dead, and the papers he gave you are enough to get you killed, too. She looked up at him, the smile fading. I'm sorry about that. About O'Brien, he went on. The waves were bearing up against the rocks, and on their heels a gust of cool ocean air. The woman didn't move. She just watched him. Even still, he couldn't stop. The plans are still in the envelope. I didn't touch them, but you have to know they'll send somebody to get them. Somebody's probably on the way. With her left hand, she reached out and gripped his wrist, those icy fingers digging into him. I didn't ask for help, she said. He heard the sound of the gun. And then the waves, relentless and brutal, and then nothing at all. Why'd they have to do that? I like that guy.
All right. Switching to the Alfred Hitchcock The Big Book, the compendium of a number of authors, Ron Goulart brings us our next story, and it's called News from Nowhere. It was right there in the window, behind the dusty glass, next to the scatters of tarnished metal jewelry, dropped peacock feathers, rusty faucets, collapsed hats, and much-traveled suitcases. An enormous oil painting of Conway. Conway, lean and smiling, wearing that broad-striped native poncho he'd always worn down there in Mexico. A small number one brush cocked over his right ear and a wineskin clutched in his knobby right hand. Conway was smiling, his gap-toothed smile, his big mustache bristling, and behind him the flat, bright Mexican countryside, the view from the back room of the girl's house. Conway, a self-portrait he must have painted while they were down there all those months. Right there in the front window of the News from Nowhere Junk Emporium, Conway smiled out on McAllister Street and all its run-down buildings and junk shops. Andrew Paulin had forgotten to keep breathing. He coughed now and gasped in air through his open mouth. He was a tall, blonde man of 30, about 20 pounds overweight and wearing a new gray suit. He'd been eating a chocolate bar and threw it down toward the gutter. "Conway," he said aloud. A heavy black woman in a green coat smiled at him as she passed. Paulin licked his lips. He'd been in the News from Nowhere shop before. He liked to browse in the antique shops and junk stores that dotted San Francisco. Now that he only had to pretend to be working as a commercial artist and could take all the time he wanted to wander Union Street and Clement and McAllister. During the 9 months he'd been back in San Francisco, he'd been down here on McAllister as often as, two or three times per week. He went over to the door of the shop and grabbed the brass knob. The knob spun around and around in his hand and nothing happened. Paulin pressed his shoulder against the grimy door and shoved. "Oh, don't tell me he's closed." There were a dozen signs pasted on the inside of the door. "Hi, Class Junk. Choice items come from everywhere to nowhere. In case of emergency, contact owner at Oak Leaf Hotel, Eddy Street." After trying the door once more, Paulin shaded his eyes and tried to see inside the long, narrow junk shop. He couldn't tell if there were any more of Conway's paintings inside or not. He turned away. He went back around the corner and climbed into his sports car. I should have gone back to that studio of his and gathered up all his stuff, he said to himself. He left the curb and headed for Eddy Street. No, Conway had a couple of other places where he bummed studio space. There's really no way of telling where he'd left all his paintings. Now look, all that is back there is a picture of Conway in that fussy realistic style of his. New neorealism, didn't he call it? That's all it is. A self-portrait of Conway. So what? Nothing in it to link him with you. You might as well buy the thing and keep it out of sight. But you have to relax. Okay. It does show the girl's house, but nobody knows that beside you and Conway and the girl. And they're both dead. The hotel clerk at the Oak Leaf had grown fat since he'd been tattooed, and the snakes and flowers on his chubby bare arms were dim and distorted. "Who?" he asked Paulin. "The old guy who runs the News from Nowhere." "What's that?" "A junk shop over on McAllister. You know the one." "Oh, you mean Mac." "Mac. The old guy who always wears a brown hat and rimless glasses." "Yeah, he's 82. He can hardly see anymore," said the fat 60-year-old clerk. "Why do you want him?" "I want to buy something out of his shop." "What?" "A painting."
Say, is this Tuesday?
Yeah, it is.
Tuesday, Mac closes up shop and goes across the bay to visit his in-laws.
You don't know where I might reach him?
Nope.
What time do you expect him back?
Oh, not till after 10 tonight.
Well, I'll call then.
Hey, switchboard closes at sharp at 10.
You'll have to wait till tomorrow, said the tattooed clerk.
That must be some terrific painting.
Paulin backed off from the brown wood counter in the Oak Leaf's small lobby.
Eh, nothing special, really.
Driving home toward his Russian Hill apartment, Paulin said to himself, now don't go acting too anxious about the darn picture. I think you're right to want to buy it and get it out of the way, but don't make everybody wonder why. There's nothing to link you with Conway or the girl. Everyone, the papers, her family, except at the crash. They believe she had an accident and was burned up in her car. Burned up along with the money she was carrying. You and Conway fixed that up. Just relax.
At the signal at the bottom of the street, he glanced over and saw a Chinese man in a station wagon watching him. He must have been talking out loud, moving his lips. He had that habit, and he'd have to watch it.
Control it. He made himself grin over at the Chinese and shrug. The light changed and he shot uphill toward his home.
The shop door opened this time. Paulin stepped inside the News from Nowhere junk store squinting. The long, low room was dim and dusty. He stepped over a fallen tuba and a feather boa in its bell.
That's an interesting painting in the window, he said.
Behind a glass counter sat an old man in a brown coat sweater. He had a soft brown hat pulled down low over his bald head. Sprawled on the streaked counter top were dozens of roller skates, a hacksaw, two cast iron skillets, a mason jar full of green marbles, three volumes of a 19th century encyclopedia, and two slices of whole wheat toast on a cracked china plate.
Far as I can tell, replied old Mac.
He touched his glasses, leaving dusty prints on the thick lenses.
My sight is slowly diminishing.
I think I might like to buy the painting. How much?
Well, far as I can see, it's the work of an authentic artist.
Mac picked up the top slice of toast and broke it slowly in half.
$20.
Pretending not to be that interested, Paulson said, well, that's a little steep.
Fellow yesterday offered me 50.
Well, why didn't you take it then?
He might come back today and do just that.
$25. You want it?
I thought you said 20.
The more we have to argue, the higher the price climbs.
Well, okay, I'll buy it. No checks. 25 in cash.
Paulin got out his wallet.
Have any more by that particular artist?
Signed his name on it, didn't he?
I forgot what he calls himself.
Well, I didn't really notice, said Paulin, drawing out 2 tens and a 5.
You wouldn't have anything else?
The old man nodded.
Yeah, one more. Out and back. Cost you $35, that one will.
Want to have a look? Go through the little door over there. Push it hard.
Guess I might as well, said Paulin. He's an interesting artist, whoever he is.
Likely he'll be famous someday, and you'll make a fortune from your chicken feed investment.
Paulin made his way around several small stuffed animals to the door leading to the back room. He pushed, and the door swung lopsidedly open. This room had a higher ceiling and was chill and damp. Great dark bureaus and chairs hulked around the room. Piles of ancient magazines, clouded mirrors, more jars of marbles. Here was another painting by Conway. Paulin inhaled, involuntarily bringing one hand up against his chest.
This one showed the girl. She was never very good-looking, Paulin said to himself. The good-looking ones never seem to have money.
Ugh, that awful peasant blouse she's always wearing, showing off all her blotchy skin, ugh.
He stepped closer to the big Conway painting, which was propped in a worn cane-bottom rocker.
When did he paint this thing?
Maybe before I met him down there, he was trying to convince her she should be a patron of the arts even before I joined him. I suppose you should feel sorry for her, wanting everyone around her to do beautiful things. Finally, he grabbed up the unframed painting. But I don't really feel anything. I can live here in San Francisco for 2-3 years on that $50,000 we got out of her. Longer if I take it easy. That's all I feel about her.
In the shop again, Paulin said, nice bit of work. I may as well take both of them. 35, did you say? Mac rubbed at his glasses and leaned toward the painting.
Oh, I forgot it was a picture of a pretty girl. That should be worth $50 at least.
She's not all that pretty.
Arguing merely ups the price around here.
Okay, all right. Here's the rest of the money. After he took the cash, Mac bent and reached under the counter. A stuffed quail fell off a shelf and bounced on his stooped back.
You know, someplace I have some nice wrapping paper I can give you.
Well, I imagine you get items from all over, huh?
From the four corners.
Max unfurled a spotted sheet of brown paper.
See if that'll fit around both of them while I dig you up a length of string.
For instance, I wonder where these two paintings came from. Paulin watched the old man shuffling off into a corner.
Mexico.
Mac knocked a model train off a sprung sofa and clutched up a ball of twine.
Really? Who brought them in? Yeah, I didn't get their names.
Two people?
Man and a wife, as I remember, brought them in over the weekend, said Mac, cutting off a piece of twine. At least, well, I presume they were man and wife. These days around Frisco, you can never tell. Couple in their early 40s, did some touristing down in Mexico, picked up these paintings. They decided they didn't want them after all. No accounting for taste.
Here. He flung the string to Paulin. Paulin had the two Conway paintings wrapped in the rough paper. He took the twine and tied up the package.
Hey, you do that pretty well. Maybe you're an artist yourself.
Well, yes, I am, replied Paulin. You wouldn't know the name of the couple, would you? Where they might live?
This isn't a pawn shop, Mac. I have no need for biographical information.
It was a calm spring day, and Paulin had walked all the way from his apartment, leaving the News from Nowhere shop. He put the wrapped Conway paintings under one arm and began walking back toward Russian Hill.
That was just like Conway, he said to himself as he walked the bright mid-morning streets, painting her exactly as she looked, not flattering her at all.
He had confidence in himself, no need for flattery. Charming, smiling, well, didn't do him much good. He's been dead at the bottom of that canyon for almost a year now. Apparently he hasn't been found yet. I didn't figure he would be. With a girl, well, it was different. We wanted them to find her and believe the $50,000 was with her.
$50,000, she told her parents she was going to use for good works around the Mexican poor. $50,000,
Conway and I convinced her would finance the three of us in a wonderful remote art colony for a long, happy year.
What an unattractive girl.
High above, gulls circled in the clear blue sky.
Smiling Conway, Paulson said to himself. I still don't like the way he treated her at the end, teasing her. Not just knocking her out quickly and dumping her in the car, no. He wanted her to know he was going to kill her, that he betrayed her. Fine sense of humor, Conway's.
Well, in a way, that made it easier to do him in. Using a variation on the original plan and dumping him unconscious in the wreck of a car of his and sending him to the bottom of the canyon way out there and nowhere. Yeah, I got rid of him in time to save nearly all the $50,000 for myself. He was breathing in more relaxed way when he stopped at a hot dog stand on Van Ness and bought a chili burger. He ate it as he walked, smiling now to himself. He saw the third painting 8 days later. It was the worst of all.
It's me,
Pollen said, stopping on the rainy street in front of the News from Nowhere junk emporium. In this Conway painting, Pollen was standing out on a red-tiled patio behind the girl's house down there in Mexico. The girl was there too, standing in an archway behind Pollen. Conway must have done that one from memory, because Pollen never posted it. Conway was good at that. He could look at you once and remember everything about you. Pollen had seen Conway do a painting of his parents years after they died, and it was perfect. Mac was taking some sort of oily gears out of a cardboard box, wheezing as he did. "Well, you're in luck." He wiped his hands on his brown pants and touched his hat. "I got another one of those pictures in by the artist you like so much." Pollen waited for the old man to mention it was a portrait of him, but Mac's eyesight must have prevented him from realizing it. "Yeah, I noticed it as I was passing." $60 for this one. I figure this particular artist is in so much demand, at least by you, I may as well cash in on it." Pollen looked from the stooped old man to the painting in the shop window. It made him very uneasy having the picture there, showing him with the girl like that. "I'll take it. Did you happen to buy this from the same couple?" Mac fished a wrinkled slip of yellow paper out of the sweatband of his brown hat and then clamped the hat back on his bald head. "Turns out these people got a dozen more by the same artist." "A dozen?" "Yeah, I don't know what they want to sell them," said the old man. "See, when I showed any interest, they got the notion that this particular artist was maybe hotter in the art world than they'd imagine. Many people suspect junk men are secret millionaires because of all the shrewd deals they pull. I'm going to have to go over there in my spare time and dicker, if it's worth it." "Oh, I could go," offered Pollen. "You cheat me out of my markup that way." Mac unfolded the scrap of paper. "Though maybe you could figure my commission in advance and then go and deal direct with these people." "Well, how much would you want?" "I'd settle for 100. Pollen sighed, got out his wallet. "All right, okay. Who are they?" "Name is Henderson. They just moved into a new place near Stinson Beach. You know where that is, over in Marin County?"
"Yeah."
"Give me the address and phone number. I'll call him." "Haven't got a phone yet," said Mac as he handed over the slip on which he'd written Henderson and Marin Beach address. "Moving in, and you know how long it takes to get a phone installed. They tell me they're at the home most every night." Paulson took the address, crumpling it in his fist. The fog kept coming in. The Henderson's house sat alone, ringed by pine trees at the end of a short road that climbed up from the beach. The low shingle house was dark, and Pollen parked his sports car away from it, off the road under some oaks. The mist rolled in across the ocean and came swirling up over the cliffside behind the house, spinning through the trees. "Now, if they aren't home," said Pollen to himself, "what difference does it make? If I can get the paintings without their seeing me, so much the better. It's likely all they have left will be here." He climbed quietly out of the car. They must have bought this stuff from someone who cleared out Conway's studio, or maybe somebody who stored some of his paintings for him. When Conway didn't come back for a while, whoever had the stuff got tired of holding it and unloaded it. Anyway, I'll have to see what these Hendersons have got. The grass was high in front of the lawn, and near a low rail fence, some sort of sign had fallen over. Pollen went directly to the front door and knocked. Well, just in case someone's home. There was no response. After a moment, Pollen slid a flashlight out of the pocket of his dark jacket and went quietly around the house. He found an unlocked window and raised it, then climbed in. This was a bedroom. No paintings here. He found them. 7 pictures in all, lined up against one wall in the living room. "Damn, Conway," said Pollen.
I hadn't realized he documented our stay down there so well. The three of them figured in most of the paintings, the girl, Conway, and his smile, and Paulin. Even the girl's car, the one they'd put her in, there it was, sitting in the field near her house, with the three of them standing around, all looking happy. "Not expecting to die," he said. Paulin checked out the other rooms into the Henderson house, but there were no more paintings. He returned to the living room and studied the seven pictures again, swinging the beam of flashlight from one to another. "It's odd, in a way, so many of Conway's paintings should show up now," he said to himself. "You know, suppose that this is some kind of setup? Oh, how could it be? Conway's dead at the bottom of that canyon, far away in Mexico." Paulin went closer to the paintings. "You don't know for sure, do you? All you did was knock him out and put him in his car and roll it over. You don't actually know he's dead." "Oh, of course he's dead. How could he have gotten out of there?" Paulin picked up the painting of the three of them standing by the girl's car. "Conway's car never caught fire, you know. You should have climbed down there and made absolutely sure he was dead." "Ah, but he was dead. If he wasn't, where has he been all these months? Suppose he did get out alive somehow. He'd know I was coming back here to San Francisco. You know how patient he was with the girl and how he loved to toy with her? Suppose the paintings are new. Maybe he's been watching me for months, figuring out how I live, the pattern of it. He could have made fresh paintings and bribed that nearly blind old man to put them on display. Now he's got you over here, and he's going to torture you like he did that girl and find out where you've got the rest of the cash hidden." Paulin put the painting back against the wall. "Oh, stop scaring yourself. Conway's dead, and it's only a coincidence these old paintings have turned up now. Gather them up and get out of here." Something made a faint noise elsewhere in the house. Paulin looked down at his free hand, shining the flashlight on it. He rubbed his forefinger slowly over his thumb, feeling what was there. Then he said, "Oh, God." It was wet paint. Well, folks, I'm out of time. Keith Tyler saying thanks so much for tuning into the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Tune in again next time, if you would, please. Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.